All right, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton. And the following is in no way intended to provide pressure from below, which may be used to justify the horrendous 9/11 Commission bill now in conference committee. Okay, now that I have that disclaimer out of the way, I'd like to welcome to the show Dr. Frederick Whitehurst. He is the founder and director of the Forensics Justice Project at the National Whistleblower Center in Atlanta. He was a 16-year veteran of the FBI, 12 years of which were spent as supervisor of the FBI Crime Lab. In 1997, after his repeated attempts to go through proper channels in order to resolve serious concerns about the Crime Lab, after those attempts were frustrated, he wrote 537 letters to the Inspector General over a time span of 8 years and was eventually identified by ABC News and was fired. After winning his lawsuit for his paycheck, he went and got a law degree and opened a practice in North Carolina. Welcome to the show, Dr. Frederick Whitehurst.
Well, I'm here.
All right. Our other guest, Sybelle Edmonds, was hired by the FBI as a translator right after September 11th. She lasted 6 months. After complaining about mistranslations, negligent and deliberate, she was shown the door. The Inspector General of the Department of Justice admits that whistleblowing was a factor in her termination. And do we have Jane Turner on the air, too? No, we did not get a hold of Jane Turner. Okay. Welcome to the show, Mrs. Edmonds.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, it's an honor to have both of you on the show today. And I am to understand that you two have a prior professional relationship. Is that correct?
I have known off, and I have known also personally Dr. Whitehurst for now almost 2 years. And I'm proud to know him.
Yes, Sybelle worked at the National Whistleblower Center, and she and I worked on some forensic projects together.
Very good. Now, Dr. Whitehurst, I think we should start with a little bit of background about your story. Now, now you came out complaining of problems in some of the major cases of the 1990s, the first World Trade Center bombing, the Waco massacre, and the Oklahoma City bombing. Is that correct?
I raised issues about a number of cases the FBI was investigating. Waco was not one of them, but issues of World Trade Center and Oklahoma City bombing, and a slew of others where people were presenting false and misleading work, forensic work.
And that was in federal and in state trials, right?
Yes, that's correct. Uh-huh.
And was there not information about Waco? I know that you narrated the movie Waco, A New Revelation.
Yes, what happened there was a private group contracted with me to actually subcontract it through someone else, and we went out, me and a fellow named Mike Chamberlain, also a former FBI agent who suffered the same sort of thing the rest of us have gone through. Mike Chamberlain and I went out and reinvestigated. Did forensic investigation at the Waco site and on the evidence itself, and then looked at the research itself, and then the film Waco, A New Revelation was produced, and I narrated it and did the overspeak on it.
Yeah, the voiceover.
Voiceover, that's right, whatever.
Well, and the last time that you were in the news that I know of, was last spring when you testified in the state trial of Oklahoma bomber Terry Nichols.
Yes.
And what was the substance of that testimony, sir?
Well, essentially, there were some issues with the testimony of a colleague of mine, and the defense wanted to present that. It was exculpatory information. The colleague had presented false and misleading testimony. And
I'm sorry, Mr. Whitehurst. We're going out to break. We'll be right back, everybody, with Sybelle Edmonds and Dr. Frederick Whitehurst on the Weekend Interview Show. right, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and our guests this hour are Dr. Frederick Whitehurst and Sabelle Edmonds, both of them FBI whistleblowers and personal heroes of mine. Now, I want to take a moment to invite everyone to listen to my previous interview of Dr. Whitehurst at from my old radio show at philipdrew.com. It's one L in Philip and D-R-U for Drew, philipdrew.com. And there's an excellent interview, if I do say so myself, of Dr. Whitehurst on that page entitled Science in Secrecy Ceases to Exist. And that was one of Dr. Whitehurst's lines in that interview, and I decided to go ahead and make it the title. So we were finishing up here a little bit on Oklahoma City. Dr. Whitehurst, last spring you testified that FBI agent named Dave Williams committed perjury when claiming that he found ammonium nitrate crystals at the crime scene at the Oklahoma City bombing. Is that correct?
No, actually, the fellow that I raised issues about was my former partner, a fellow named Stephen Burmeister.
Oh, pardon me.
Yes, Steve gave false and misleading testimony about the contamination controls in the lab, which led me, in reading it, was blatantly wrong information and led me to question. He was the fellow that found ammonium nitrate crystals, or supposedly found ammonium nitrate crystals on evidence. Now, I saw the stuff. I knew it was there. I mean, I believe the data, but why he would testify under oath that the lab, about the contamination controls in the lab, which what he said was just plain wrong, why he would be argumentative and defensive in that raised my concern, and you know, I personally know him, and I got thinking, well, okay, maybe those crystals on specimen Q507 weren't there. I mean, they were there when I looked at them, but maybe they didn't come from. It casts reasonable doubt in my mind about that evidence. That's what the testimony was about. David Williams himself, he wrote a report which appeared to me to be seriously flawed. But, Scott, he brought me that report and asked me to review it. And the FBI senior management found out I was reviewing it, they stepped in and Ray Sponge came, but it was too late then, and Dave was told, don't talk to me anymore. So I had raised issues with Dave giving false and misleading testimony in the World Trade Center first trial, but the trial of Mohammed Salameh, but not in Oklahoma.
I see. And, folks, you're beginning to get the idea of what kind of a man Frederick Whitehurst is by, first of all, what he's describing and just the way that he answers the question. And it shouldn't be much of a surprise to you that something like Fred Whitehurst gets drummed right out of the FBI. It seems a pattern that when an FBI agent tries to do the right thing, he gets, Greg Palast, in quoting an FBI agent, calls it the boot on the neck from their boss who won't let them do their job, and they eventually get drummed right out of the FBI. This is what happened to Sabelle Edmonds. She was hired right after September 11th. She's originally from Turkey and was hired to be a translator right after September 11th. But when she started doing her job, they showed her the door. Is that right, Ms. Edmonds?
Well, that's more or less is right. I started reporting certain issues ranging from unqualified translator mistranslating important counterintelligence and counterterrorism-related documents. Also, security breaches by several translators who were in touch with the targets of investigations, and they were blocking information from getting to the agents. So I reported these issues for several months within the Bureau. I did not go out. I did not go out blowing the whistle. I just thought I would do my job by reporting these issues to first the mid-level management, then all the way up to Director Mueller and his assistant, Dale Watson. And after reporting these issues, I was first asked to back off and not to pursue this any further, because if they were to investigate some of these cases or admit to it, that would have bring about some severe consequences for the Bureau. It would question It's thoroughness in conducting background investigations and granting top secret clearances. Also, legal liability because these mistranslated documents, some intentional, some due to incompetence, well, they use these documents to obtain FISA, all sorts of warrants. They use these documents as evidence in court. So it was going to bring about some severe consequences. So I was asked to keep quiet and not to report it any further, these issues.
So even though the biggest crime in American history, well, since Wounded Knee anyway, had just taken place in New York and 3,000 people were killed, still protecting the FBI itself was more important than getting the job done of actually translating intercepts from Al-Qaeda.
That's absolutely correct. And when we say they, we should be really careful because almost all agents that I worked with, they were very frustrated with these issues. Actually, some of them had directly complained about these issues to the headquarters, and all the agents, field agents I worked with, I mean, these were solid, patriotic people who were doing their jobs. And these issues and these decisions were occurring within the mid-level bureaucratic administrative management in the headquarters and also in the FBI's Washington field office. So it's very important to separate this. We usually say, you know, the FBI and the incompetence of the FBI, but we need to also make this distinction that there are many good people within the FBI, and these issues are caused by a few who, as Dr. Whitehurst knows, what happens is those people get to be promoted, and they try to protect their turf. And after reporting these issues to the FBI OPR, they started retaliating against me openly. First, they came to my house and they confiscated my computer, my husband's computer, accusing me of communicating these issues with outside the bureau, which at that point I was not. And they took the hard drive apart and found nothing because I was not doing that. Then they came and they forced me to take a polygraph exam. And I did. And I passed the polygraph exam regarding these reports and allegations. And at that point, I knew that I could go no further within the Bureau, and I took these issues to all the appropriate channels out there that you should take it to, which is the Judiciary Committee within the Senate and the Congress, the House, and to the Department of Justice's Inspector General's office by saying, these are the issues, here are these documents, these are the witnesses. Do something.
And yet, even though the Inspector General and the House and the Senate have investigated your claims and, as far as I can find in my reading, have not contradicted you anywhere, they're not allowed to come forward and tell their version of your story. Why is that?
Well, this is this massive cover-up by overusing secrecy inappropriately. For example, last May, and this is after the Senate Judiciary Committee came out publicly, confirmed that during two unclassified meetings with the FBI, FBI confirmed all these allegations and they denied none. So last May, Attorney General Ashcroft retroactively classified everything that these senators had on their website and all their letters, basically gagging them to even referring to my languages, the languages I speak, the languages I translated for. And as you're aware, after a year and a half of delay, Department of Justice's Inspector General's office completed their report, but the entire report is classified per Attorney General's request, so the public can't see this report. So all the channels that I pursued end up being just nothing.
And so you're limited in what you can say because of the confidentiality agreements that you've signed, and the congressmen who know your story and would like to tell it, they are forbidden by this gag order from discussing the parts of the story that you're not allowed to tell, but they should be able to, right?
Correct. And what they are using to accomplish this is this rarely invoked State Secrets Act. Again, I'm emphasizing rarely invoked. As far as I know, nobody from the FBI administration, a translator, not an agent, not an undercover, has ever been slapped by state secrets. Usually you hear it in relation to the CIA or DIA undercovers. Now, this state secrets, they are citing certain diplomatic, certain sensitive diplomatic relations would be hurt if this information were to come out, and also certain foreign business relations would be hurt if this information was to come out. Now, this is the excuse they have been using without giving any other further explanation, saying what diplomatic relations are they referring to. They gag the court. They blocked my court proceedings by asserting the state secret privilege and saying, due to this mosaic theory, this case cannot even be discussed. So no hearings, no arguments, no oral arguments, no discovery. And they had this in-camera ex parte presentation of certain classified documents to the judge. And boom, the judge came out 3 months ago and threw out the case.
Now, another unintended consequence of this story being told might be the problem could be solved, and maybe we could get qualified translators in there to do the job and that sort of thing.
Well,
I mean, compromising diplomatic relationships is one side effect, but, you know, actually fixing the problem could be another.
And none of these problems will be fixed without transparency, without visibility of these issues. And there's another aspect to it, and this is even after 9/11, we had a lot of intelligence coming regarding some of the terrorist activities or support network of these terrorist activities that did not come through the counterterrorism investigations, but through counterintelligence. And I was told by the agents that I was working with, that the State Department would come and ask them not to pursue or transfer these counterintelligence information relevant to our fight against terrorists, to counterterrorism, because it would affect certain diplomatic relations. Here, as you said, we had 3,000 people losing their lives. Here they're putting us on this various color-coded threat system, and they're compromising our civil liberties with Patriot Act, yet there are certain sensitive diplomatic relations that is worth protecting, that's worth more than our national security and what occurred here.
Dr. Whitehurst, how is it that the least competent and least trustworthy people make it to the management positions in the FBI, where good people like you and Mrs. Edmonds have to deal with a boss who won't let them do their job?
Well, Scott, first of all, I'm not a competent manager. There's another side to what Sabell has to say. We're caught in a catch-22. I believe very strongly this concept that if you don't lie, you don't fly in the FBI. Back in the 80s, there was a program called the MAP, Management Aptitude Program. They came to the field and they said, anybody who wants to be a manager, hold your hand up. I mean, it was as simple as that. People that wanted to go to FBI headquarters, generally not the people that had a lot of experience in the field, and they promoted a lot of people into positions that they were not capable of handling. Those people then had terrorists to protect. We're caught in a catch-22 here. Sabell was with the Bureau for a short while of time and may not pick up on this. The problem we've got is these incompetents endanger our national security. However, exposing the criminal activity of them endangers our national security. You see, so we're caught in a catch-22. There is no accountability. There's no audit at the FBI. Period. There is no audit. There's no outside audit. The argument that they give is that if you audit us, you know, you could expose national security issues or the crooks could find out about us or whatever. They could bring in auditors that had security clearances just like Sabell Edmonds and I had to audit the process, but that were not under control of the FBI director. They could be audited just like the normal citizen is audited. excuse me. But right now, there's not only not any accountability, there's just nobody audits the process. Nobody can audit the process. So we don't know how many of those people are crooks. Now, Scott, think about this, and it's not too far-fetched. The FBI has been infiltrated by spies, Robert Hansen, Earl Pitt, whatever, by spies. Foreign governments have infiltrated the FBI. The FBI has had agents that joined the mafia. They whipped the Boston issues there. Suppose that top management of the FBI was compromised. What recourse do American citizens have? We don't have any recourse. The safest place in the United States of America right now for a criminal is within the walls of the FBI headquarters. The safest place because because nobody can touch one of those people. Robert Hansen was reported again and again and again by colleagues. Nothing ever happened.
Well, I think that could be taken. You could.
It's terrifying.
You could draw that out and say the safest place for any criminal is within the walls of the state in general. You know, the FBI maybe particularly.
But if I wanted
to kill people, I would go work for the sheriff's department rather than have them chase me around. I'd go be one of them.
But the response to that is not armed insurrection. It's not running around and saying, now I'm the boss and you're not. The response to that is we have a government of the people. And Sybil Edmonds is an American citizen, and I'm an American citizen. And frankly, one of my colleagues in Singapore said, Fred, they would have cut their losses and just killed you for what you did. Well, that didn't happen. There are mechanisms. Now, Sybil has run into a wall. I found mechanisms personally that address these issues. And, you know, we sued and we won because American law allowed us to point out problems. You see those problems all over the United States being exposed now. With Sybil, we're in the middle of a war, and it's a horrible, it's a military and civilian kind of a war, this thing called terrorism. We don't know whether to apply the law or to apply warfare tactics. You know, we're facing loss of liberties, but the liberties that we're losing so often are coming from these crooks that are within that organization.
So, Dr. Whitehurst, do you think it's possible to have accountability through the system?
Oh, you're darn tootin'. The FBI is not, I mean, you know, so many managers there have forgotten that the gold on their badges came from the gold in our pockets. And before I buy a product, I want to know whether it's doing the job right or not. And there can be accountability. And we're getting there. We're getting there. You had invited Jane Turner to be on, and I'm sorry that she didn't come on. But there are a large number of people that are dealing with that system that are part of a network in this country right now. There's no organization to it. There's no money associated with it. We're just all interconnected.
Well, and you got a website.
Huh? Well, there's not just that website, but I invite the FBI to join that network to become, well, the FBI is an American organization and institution. But the management structure of the FBI is not. They are a nation in and unto themselves. And they will fight you. They will fight you, Scott. They will fight the American public to a standstill, if they can, to keep their jobs and to keep their what they perceive as power.
Fred,
go ahead.
I'm probably the most cynical person about state power that you could ever talk to. I mean,
okay.
Really. Honestly, though, after September 11th is very easy for me to imagine bosses in the FBI, you know, maybe over the head of the middle managers, maybe the director, the deputy director somewhere saying, all right, everybody, this is serious. I want these translations done. I want them done right. I want proper people in here. I want proper security clearances. This is an emergency. September 11th just happened. The two giant towers just fell down. And yet I'm finding that when I'm reading Mrs. Edmonds' story that there's nothing like that took place in the FBI.
No,
they did everything they could just to cover themselves.
No, and you're right. As a young agent out in California in the 80s, I was ordered to log counterintelligence, foreign counterintelligence hours, though I had nothing to do with it at all. And they specifically told us, I mean, it was sent down from on high, we've got to convince Congress to give us more foreign counterintelligence dollars. So I'm supposed to lie to Congress? And me and my senior resident agent just refused to do it. I mean, there was nothing out in Northern California for me to look at, you know?
Well, and that's part of your story, too, isn't it, Sybil, that they told you, no, don't translate those because we need those to stack up so that we can get more money from the Congress next year.
Absolutely, and this is a few days after 9/11 when they were coming on TV begging for translators to go and apply with them and screaming about the backlog and the necessity of having more translators. So I joined them, and I went in there, and they were 2 months away from going to the Congress and making their case that they needed to have more translators and increase budget. So we were told in there to slow down and let the work pile up, because in November, when we go there to present our case, we have to show the number of pages, the number of audio tapes, etc., that we have as backlog, and the larger this number is, the more number of translators we are going to receive, and the increased budget and expand the department. And this is only a few days after 9/11. And the same thing is true with the agents in the field who were going and trying to chase and try to catch some people who might have been responsible. Now, we would receive certain documents that, in a way, would clear some of those people who were detained, but the headquarters wanted us to hold off on sending it back to the agents who needed those documents to move on to the next guy or get this guy detained and have a decision made so that they would show this large number of people that they arrested to say that, hey, look what we are doing. Look how many people we have arrested. It was just surreal.
Sure. Well, and this is, you know, it's funny because this is very typical, I think, of any government agency. There's in that old movie Falling Down where he says, what's wrong with the road? Well, we just have to make sure to spend all our money in our budget. But what your story really brings forward here, Mrs. Edmonds, is that even in the very most important matter in the entire country in, you know, since the Cold War, the most important matter, the very same laws of bureaucracy apply. This is the Weekend Interview Show. The guests are FBI hero whistleblower Sybelle Edmonds and Dr. Frederick Whitehurst. Everybody stay tuned. We'll be right back on the Republic Broadcasting Network. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and the guests this hour are Sybelle Edmonds and Dr. Frederick Whitehurst, both of them FBI whistleblowers. And I must reiterate that this show about the deficiencies in the Federal Bureau of Investigation is in no way intended to provide pressure from below, which may be used to justify the horrendous 9/11 commission bill that is now in conference committee. And I know that, you know, in times like these when the FBI is under fire and I feel like joining those firing at them, I surely don't want to create pressure from below to justify making matters worse, which is, of course, what our Congress is proposing to do. Now, Mrs. Edmonds, I would like to get into some of the details of your story here as much as you're allowed to talk about. You did mention the poor kid who couldn't even speak English, who was assigned to be a translator, Kevin Taskinson. Can you tell us a little bit about that story?
Correct. Mr. Tashkasan joined the Bureau in 2001. I believe it was October 1st. Now, this individual had lived in the United States for less than 3-4 years, and he never took any English classes when he came to this country, and he did not have any prior training in English language. And he was working in a restaurant in food industry. And because of the nepotism going on in that was going on in that department, this arrangement was made, and he was brought in, and he was put in charge of translating these top secret counterintelligence, counterterrorism-related intelligence. Now, not only that, he failed all given English proficiency exams, even those that are considered ESL English as second level, second language. He also failed the target language. That means his mother tongue. And I don't know how he can even manage doing that. So this person was hired, was given this task. And, in fact, they sent this individual in February 2002 to Guantanamo Bay. And he was stationed there for 2 months, where he translated for over 10 detainees from various Central Asian countries who spoke various dialects of Turkic languages, and including other Turkish detainees, knowing that this individual, in fact, had failed all proficiency exams in English and most of them in the target language. Now, in February, it's very interesting, the FBI also received this offer of help from both NSA and the State Department that if they did not have qualified translators, the Bureau could ask them to translators, you know, just as a loan.
Sure.
And they did not. And that was like this turf battle. Oh, we are not going to get any translators from those agencies. We rather send this unqualified translator there for 2 months and use this translator to translate for interrogations of these detainees. Now, based on these translations, detainees are either released or detained for a longer period of time. Based on these translations, because the agents don't speak these languages, they have no way of verifying the quality of the work. There is no quality review, any quality check. And also, we were supposed to receive any possible future attacks or plots or plans for any future attacks from these detainees, right? That was the purpose of the FBI going there and interrogating these people and having these translators. Yet knowingly, they were sending, and Mr. Tashkistan was only one of these individuals, people who were unqualified.
And as you point out, these are translations which could eventually be used at their military tribunals.
Correct.
With a big official FBI stamp on it that makes it official.
Correct. And the same thing is true with the detainees here in New Jersey, New York, in Wilmington. I mean, most of these people who were detained, some of these people were just arrested for certain minor immigration charges, but most of these people did not speak English. Therefore, translators were being sent to participate and be there, present, and interpret the interrogations of these people and the documents that these people carried. And as I said, these documents are used as evidence in court.
Can you please tell us a bit about Melik Khan Dickerson and her husband, Douglas? I know this is a big part of your story, and I also know that you're not allowed to really tell me the good parts.
Yeah, you're right. Mr. Dickerson was hired, later, about a few weeks after she started working there, the agent in charge of the counterintelligence division for that target country asked me to retranslate documents that she previously had translated. Most of these certain targets, investigations on certain targets, were just stamped as reviewed but found to be not to be pertinent. And sure enough, the translation showed, the retranslation, that in fact they were pertinent. And then we found out in the Bureau, the agent and myself, that in fact Ms. Dickerson used to work for that same target that she was translating for before she joined the Bureau. And she and her husband had ongoing relationship with two other targets from another investigation that FBI was conducting. And again, this issue was confirmed because the FBI authorities went to the Senate Judiciary Committee, and during these unclassified meetings, they admitted. They said, yes, she did not declare this in her application. She lied in her application. She had ongoing relationship with certain targets, yet some of those targets were informed by her, and they left the United States abruptly. And yet this individual was granted TSC.
Well,
security clearance.
She and her husband had tried to recruit you and your husband, right?
Correct.
Can you tell us about a bit about that briefly? They came to your house, right?
Correct. They basically started talking about, I refer to it as a semi-legitimate organization, to a certain semi-legit organization that may have legit front but illegitimate activities, and ask whether or not we were a member. And they tried to recruit my husband and told him in order to get in, all we had to do was to basically tell this certain semi-legit organization where I worked and what I did for my livelihood at the FBI. And in return, we would get certain financial rewards and certain privileges. And again, this was the organization that was the FBI's target, and again, this was confirmed. And these individuals both had TSCs.
And your boss refused to do anything about this when you told him?
The first reaction was this. After this was confirmed, because the agent I worked for, he reported this issue to the security division, and it came down to this issue. If we were to admit to this case and investigate it, criminally investigate it, and refer it to the counter espionage division. It would bring into question all the other TSDs we have granted to other translators. That means they would come down and shake up this department, and who knows, and this is the exact quote, who knows how many more Dickersons would fall out if they were to come and shake up the department.
Oh, I mean, we wouldn't want them to fall out. We want to keep them up in there, right?
Yes, because it's too embarrassing for them to admit that this is the type of background investigations they conducted. Now, how did that happen? I have no idea. Whose fault was that? I have no idea. But then it comes down to how can we cover up? How can we prevent this embarrassing thing to come out and cause more problems? And, in fact, during one of our recent press conference, the agent in charge of the person, counterintelligence operations manager for India, Afghanistan, Pakistan, John Cole, stated that since 2000, year 2000, he has been informing the FBI management and also the Congress of at least 12 highly important cases of espionage activities by search and translators. And in one instance, this one translator had compromised an informant. And yet the Bureau, Washington Field Office and headquarters, they did not transfer these cases. They did not inform FBI's counter-espionage division regarding these cases. 12 incidents that he has been informing the Congress of. And this person, they basically forced him to resign 7 months ago, last March, March 2004. After 18 years working for the Bureau, this individual resigned. He gave up. He couldn't take it anymore.
I'm Scott Horton, and it's the Weekend Interview Show. My guests are Sybelle Edmonds and Dr. Frederick Whitehurst, both of them FBI whistleblowers. Sybelle, you told Christopher DeLisio of BalkanAnalysis.com and Antiwar.com that when the truth is known, which, by the way, everyone, she is under a couple of different gag orders, and so are the congressmen who would like to tell you her story. But you told Christopher DeLisio that when the truth is finally known, that elected officials will go to prison.
Yes, I said certain officials, and including certain elected officials, will be standing criminal prosecution, and that's correct.
Executive branch officials?
I cannot give any more specific information on that, but
I know. I just wanted to push that button to make sure.
But it just tells you about the state secrets that they have been telling the public they are trying to protect is actually to protect certain criminal activities to be known so that certain people would not stand criminal prosecution.
Dr. Whitehurst, when I was studying Jane Turner, your fellow FBI whistleblower, one of the phrases that I found in interviews of her a few times was in her investigation of child abuse cases on Indian reservations, she talked about the victims not being worthy of service.
Not being what?
Not being worthy of service.
Oh, yeah.
That, well, they're just poor old Indians out on the reservation. Who really cares whether they're raping their kids or not?
Yeah.
And that those kids aren't really worthy of protection by the FBI. But what's really throwing me, I mean, as horrible as that sounds and as anti-individualism as that is, it seems absolutely incredible to me that the entire country apparently is not worthy of service of the FBI, that they would rather, what I'm learning here, is they would rather protect themselves than protect the American people every time. The bosses.
You need to go to where Sybelle Edmonds went. We're not talking about FBI agents. We're not talking about FBI agents in the field. We're not talking about the rank and file.
Right.
We're talking about some people that are protecting their turf, Washington, D.C. And it gets to the point where you say to yourself, this is so ludicrous, it's got to be by design. Nobody can do that because they're stupid or whatever. You know, I mean, it's got to be by design. And whether, you know, there's racism everywhere you look, there's racism in law enforcement, there's racism in industry, there's, you know, there's discrimination based upon gender or whatever. I mean, it's a fact of life. When it comes out, the FBI should deal with it immediately and very, you know, very positively. Just, hey, we don't want you anymore, you're gone. My own experience is they won't. They just won't. For whatever reason, Okay, but as I listen to Sabell, as I listen to other whistleblowers that come to me and ask me, how are you going to survive this thing, and they've already been discharged and they're telling me about the situation, I say, again, and it sounds almost, the word that Sabell uses, surreal.
It sure does.
But what would happen? What has happened?
Oh, I lost some volume there, Dr. Whitehurst.
Huh? I say, what happened if the FBI has been compromised? What protection do we have if it has been compromised? You know, what Sabell's talking about is crazy. But the fact that people were altering my reports for years without my knowledge or authorization is just as crazy. Where is that going? The fact that Robert Hansen could survive all that time, and Earl Pitt, who was, as the Bureau's got an expression called, you know, who's your juice man back at headquarters? Who's the guy that's supporting you? Who's covering for Robert Hansen? Who in the system covered for him? I have personally talked to agents who reported Robert Hansen. You know the Hansen story.
Oh, yeah.
Who reported Robert Hansen, and nothing. Who was covering for him? What protection do we have from what Louis Free described as possibly what could be the most dangerous organization in the American government? What protections do we have? We have none, Scott. But we do not need to protect ourselves from FBI agents. We need to protect ourselves from the criminal element that's within the FBI. There's a criminal element. It's a microcosm of society. There's a criminal element in any organization. And how do we protect ourselves from that? And that's what's terrifying. Osama bin Laden doesn't terrify me, Scott. I'm allowed to shoot him. If a man came after me, I can protect myself. But the criminal in the FBI, I'm not allowed to do anything about. I am required by law to stand there and let him rape my family and rape my liberties. You there?
Yeah, I'm here.
I mean, that bothers me. It bothers me to the point where I want somebody somewhere, and if that means Sabell and I and Jane Turner and a whole bunch of us, that we'll just expose it, and we'll keep exposing it.
Fred, do you worry that as bad as, obviously you guys, and I'm trying to do my part down here as best I can, talking bad about the FBI, do we not make it easier for those in Congress who would rather replace it with an American version of the British MI5 and would rather just rewrite all federal police power and make it 100 times worse, which is what they're trying to do right now?
Well, you know, I'm not really fond of something called Homeland Security, but it gives me a little bit of peace of mind to know that there's another organization out there that, if the FBI cannot get back on its feet for whatever reason, and it is laying flat on its back now, if it can't get back on its feet, then some other people someplace else can try a different way. And I thoroughly believe that that's what Homeland Security is about. The FBI has failed so badly, and it's not guys in the field. Those are they'll risk your life. They're the bravest people that I've ever known. Good support people, good agents. It's that management cadre there that are, they're bureaucrats and they're protecting themselves. And they'll also hurt this nation for a few dollars more.
Yeah, they seem to be dragging us down with them.
Well, I'm not sure, Scott, they're dragging the country down. I mean, you know, that was a tragedy in New York and at the Pentagon. But we're resilient and we will strike back. We will, you know, recover even from that failure.
As we're running out of time here, I want to make sure that I have give Sabell Edmonds a chance. We're going out to break right now. When we get back from this break, I want to ask Sabell Edmonds about the Iranian asset who warned about Osama bin Laden using planes to attack the United States in April of 2001. The guests are Frederick Whitehurst and Sabell Edmonds, both of them FBI whistleblowers and heroes of mine. It's the Weekend Interview Show. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. The website is weekendinterviewshow.com. We have all the archives up there, and the archives of this show hopefully will be up sometime soon. My name is Scott Horton, and the guests are Sibel Edmonds and Dr. Frederick Whitehurst. And we're wrapping up the show now. We're last five-minute segment here, and I have one question left for each of you. Mrs. Edmonds, I was hoping that you could explain to us a little bit about the Iranian asset who warned about an attack, an upcoming attack with airplanes. And for Dr. Whitehurst, I hope that you could tell us a little bit about the National Whistleblower Center and the website Whistlestop, FBIWhistlestop.com, and such like that. So first of all, Sibel Edmonds, the Iranian asset and what he told the FBI.
Yes, first let me say that this information first became public because another translator, Mr. Sarshar, blew the whistle on this issue and he testified for the 9/11 Commission. And in fact, Director Mueller admitted that this was the case and that this issue and this case happened and that he himself was even surprised that the 9/11 Commission did not even ask him about this and they did not put it on their timeline. So this is even confirmed by Director Mueller. In April 2001, a certain FBI asset who had been on the payroll since 1992 and was considered a very reliable informant informed two agents and a translator during a meeting that through his contacts in Afghanistan, because where he came from years like in 1980s, in that country, this asset's job was overseeing intelligence and counterintelligence for Afghanistan region. And he had maintained his contacts and sources there. So he informed these two agents and this translator of a very specific, of the specific information that bin Laden had issued this terrorist attack. It was going to take place in the United States. He named certain major cities that were going to be targets. And the fact that airplanes were going to be used, and I would like to emphasize that he didn't say airplanes are going to be hijacked, he said airplanes would be involved, and that the individuals who were going to carry out these attacks, they were already here in this country. They were in the United States.
And this was in April of 2001.
April 2001.
And the 9/11 Commission didn't even ask a single question about this.
No, and they interviewed all relevant witnesses, and they established it. And as I said, this was confirmed. Now, these two agents, they did their jobs right. They came back to the headquarters, and they filled out these 302 forms, and they filed it. And the translator also wrote it up in a verbatim translation and also the documents. And it went to the certain individual who was in charge of counterterrorism for that involving that also that country, and nothing happened. It did not go anywhere else. Just stayed there. Nobody took any action. Nobody did anything. Now, was it due to incompetence? I don't know. But after 9/11... and with this timeline, even the 9/11 Commission is not putting this in timeline in their public documents, and it's just what they call a report. It's just omission and distortion.
Okay, now I want anyone who believes that George Bush is leading a wonderful war against terrorism to go and type Sibel Edmonds into your Google and do some reading before you go cast that vote. And now, Dr. Whitehurst, you have about 50 seconds to tell us about FBIWhistlestop.com and the National Whistleblower Center.
Well, I would just recommend any citizen that any, particularly any FBI agent that has concerns, to just type up FBIWhistlestop.com. Just go visit the site. There's a bunch of us there that'll talk to you. We don't want to talk to you about information you're not supposed to give us. But about how to survive if you come forward and tell the truth when it's not a popular truth. National Whistleblower Center is a place that will listen to your issues, bunch of lawyers there that you can talk to, and they can give you some idea about how to move forward also and survive what's about to happen to you.
All right. Thank you both very much. We'll see you all next week. Michael Badnarik will be on.